So, we talked for about an hour. It was a lovely interview. We got over so many topics.
We
You were
did.
really getting a chance to rant and tell your mind. And what happened was, and I've never had this happen. I've Skyped, I don't know how many thousand times or something. We were talking about Dead in the Water and
Right.
for the USS Liberty, and the screen just turns black. And I just wait a second, and I couldn't hear you or anything, so I go to get my phone to tell you what's going on. Control-Alt-Delete to see if anything's going. Nothing would happen, so I had to restart the computer. And the worst thing is, the program I use to record these, it's when the call ends that it saves it. And I cannot find that anywhere. It didn't save. I don't know what happened. I mean,
Oh.
I was really enjoying this talk and looking forward to putting that up. I don't know if you have time to go over Perez at all again, but I don't.
I could we could go yeah, we could do we go over to Brad Paris, yeah. Maybe call the NSA and maybe get a copy from him
I need to
anyway.
see that Snowden. Yeah, exactly. I would like to see that movie. I'm looking forward to that too.
Yeah, I saw it the other night at San Rafael with my sister. And
Well, I mean, I think I started off talking about Ben Gurion and him being a protege
right.
of a guy from the Jewish agency who had worked with the Nazis and coming in. And we had covered the Levon affair, we had covered COINTELPRO. It was so many great things. I hope we can do
Was
this
any of
again.
that reported? Is that all gone?
I think it's all gone. I haven't had time to dig
We can
through, but
start. Okay,
yeah.
Paris. Actually, we can start. My, we had talked about me walking
Going to the
going to
post office with the flag, tell that
the post
story.
office
Yeah.
the other day and seeing the American flag at half staff. And I walked into the post office and I said, "Why is the flag at half staff?" And a man there turned to me, and he was waiting in line. He said, "It was for Shimon Peres. He was a Nobel Prize winner." I said, "He's an Israeli. This is the United States." And I walked out. And I saw over my storage, my place I keep storage, I saw the flag at half staff. It's extraordinary. I have never seen American flag at half staff, although President Obama, in talking about the pantheon of heroes in which he put Shimon Peres, compared to Mandela, I don't believe we had half flags at half staff when Nelson Mandela died. And comparing Peres and putting him in Mandela's category is just extraordinary chutzpah and arrogance on the part of American president. I should mention that a week before he was elected president, Chicago Daily News quoted Avner Mikva, a Jewish attorney used to work under Clinton, and that he said that Obama would be the first Jewish president. And so, and it was Chicago wealthy Jewish backers of Obama, the Lester Crown Company and the Priskers, who were the people who really pushed Obama into where he is today. But getting back to Shimon Peres. You have to say, when it comes to Israel, from Israel's perspective, he was a great man because he was responsible for not only Israel's nuclear weaponry program, which the American media can't even say. They,
They
I
can't
use
even
they,
acknowledge it exists.
pardon?
They won't even say it exists. Even after Mordecai Vanunu took pictures of warheads, the American press refuses to admit it.
If nothing else shows the power of the Zionists over the American media, it's the issue of Israel's nuclear weapons. Now, the politicians won't mention it, and one of the reasons the politicians, the president won't mention it, because it means that according to U.S. law, that aid to Israel would have to be cut off. And we off camera, we had mentioned that Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy on August 11th filed a lawsuit to stop aid from Israel from going to stop aid going to Israel on the basis of U.S. law, not grand feelings, U.S. law that stipulates that any country that is not a sign of non-proliferation
treaty, yeah,
that is found to have be trafficking in nuclear weaponry or nuclear armament is not entitled to receive U.S. funding. And so the reason that U.S. presidents and officials don't acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons is not just because they're subjugated by Israel, which they are, but because if they said it out loud, they would be required to obey the U.S. law. Mr. President, you signed the oath to support the Constitution. That's all the laws of the U.S., of the land of the United States. And every president has not done that because it would mean ending U.S. aid to Israel. But Shimon Peres is well aware of that. And he was the one considered the father of Israel's nuclear weapons program. Also in 67, he became the father of Israel's settlement program. Mm-hmm. And whereas many people in the United States, particularly so-called progressive Jews, like to talk about Likud and Begin and all these people being the horrible ones, it was actually the Labor Party that started under Shimon Peres that started expanded the settlements into the occupied territories. So this is Shimon Peres. He also, he wasn't, because he was never a general, he never had the kind of popularity that military men have in Israel. And because the Israeli Defense Forces, so-called Israel Defense Forces, is worshipped by the public, he was never, he never wore one of these, he was in the military, but he never wore one of these uniforms with all these epaulets and so on to strut around like Israeli generals strut around. But he did have his, he was a war criminal because, in his own right, because in 1996, when he happened to be running Israel, he launched an attack in Lebanon, which was titled The Grapes of Wrath. Very religious people. They invented the Yahweh, displacing all the other cool gods that other people believed in for a vengeful and a god who thought it was worse to sleep with someone's wife than to hold people in slavery, at least according to the Ten Commandments. He bombed. He ordered the bombing of a UN center in Qana in Lebanon, where Lebanese civilians had gone for refuge during this Israeli bombing campaign. And the Israelis had been informed of this. They knew about it. And they had aerial observation of this. And they bombed this center, the UN center, killing well over 100 people, several hundred people. And then they pretended to say it was an accident. But then it was found out that it was documented that the Israelis actually had aerial observation of what was going on, so they couldn't claim this. And so that story passed out of history. And then Shimon Peres, of course, he was already a Nobel Prize winner. And I should mention Oslo. They keep bringing Oslo up as this great peace treaty. Well, Oslo was signed and negotiated for a number of reasons most people don't know about. Mm-hmm. One is at the time, Yasser Arafat's reputation among the Palestinians was at the lowest ebb it had ever been. And the Israelis were really afraid who would come next. They had to do something to save Arafat's behind. And I actually wrote this in the Middle East Labor Bulletin before Oslo. Israel is going to do something to save Arafat. So I predicted Oslo. The other thing was the European Union was coming into its own, and they had this European Parliament, which Israel was very frightened of. And the European Parliament and also governments in Europe were demanding that Israel show some sign that they were willing to have peace with the Palestinians or make a settlement with the Palestinians. Because at that time, they weren't as enthralled to Israel as they are today. The Jewish lobbies there are being stronger than ever now. And so they needed to do something that would prove to the Europeans that they were serious about peace. So this was Oslo. Now, Oslo, Arafat sent Abu Mazen, better known as Mahmoud Abbas, to Oslo to negotiate. There are a number of really excellent Palestinian lawyers, none of whom, Raja Shahada and Raja Shirani, really good lawyers. Not a single lawyer was sent to Oslo to help the Palestinians with the negotiations. And that was deliberate because Arafat was selling Israel, was selling Palestine to the Israelis. By agreeing to let Israel have this area in the West Bank, Area C, this was legitimizing Israel's presence in the West Bank. And this was unprecedented for someone supposedly representing a people under occupation to give their land away to the occupier.
Well, he's being paid off through his wife. We found out after he died all the millions of dollars that Arafat was receiving.
Yeah, Arafat, it turned out, Arafat was getting $8 million a month paid into his private bank account. Mm-hmm. And he got it to at least $375 million from Israel. And the reason that came out, when Natan Sharansky, the former Russian dissident, was in the government, and he had written a book about democracy. And he complained, he was a member of the Israeli Knesset, or cabinet rather, he complained that Israel should not be giving Arafat $8 million a month because Arafat was not running a democratic Palestinian Authority, which is kind of a joke, actually.
You'd have to wonder about Abbas. But he wanted today, that to stop. But he's getting paid.
Abbas is obviously being paid. You know, he comes out with these statements, these threats, what he's going to do about Israel. But he was the one who sabotaged any investigation after the Goldstone report. He had one of the things that was interesting in Oslo. One of the stipulations was the Palestinian Authority would suppress further resistance to the occupation. And I was sitting the day it was signed, it was announced with a group of Palestinians in San Francisco, and Nawad al-Sharif, an Egyptian woman, a feminist writer and very radical woman, and she said Arafat has agreed to be Israel's sheriff. And that's what it was. And so the Palestine Authority started repressing further resistance to Israeli occupation, and they have been doing it faithfully ever since. And you have any number of Israeli officials in Shin Bet and Israeli security agencies who praise the security forces of the Palestine Authority for collaborating with Israel. And that means that in the middle of the night, when the Israelis decide to go into a village or a Palestinian town to arrest somebody, there is nobody there to defend them. These cowards, these traitors who wear the uniform of the Palestinian militia, they are like, they're working for Israel. If they were Irish, they wouldn't be alive. I mean, I'll tell you that. The IRA would not put up with Irish working for the British. We saw what happened in Northern Ireland. But the Palestinians somehow put up with this. And Abbas, whose term of office expired in 2009 after an extension of a year, is still considered to be the president of Palestine, of the Palestinian Authority, when he actually has no legal basis to do anything. And that's because Netanyahu and Obama and all these European governments want him to be in this position. There's nothing ever like this in any kind of people struggle. This is why the Palestinian struggle has been a failure. There's no way to put a lipstick on it. There's no way to say Samud, which is Palestinian steadfastness, which is really great. The people hung in there, but they're not winning. After Oslo, the situation was as bad as it had been since 1948, with a difference. There's no fighting back. It's interesting, in 2002, a Palestinian sniper, whose name I don't recall, I can't recall it, but at a checkpoint, he was able to shoot and get away 9 Israeli soldiers and 2 settlers. Kill them. This man's name should be a hero. He was a Palestinian hero. He was doing what people have done against soldiers in occupied France and occupied Italy during World War II and other countries. But you don't hear his name. And I suspect that the Israelis told the Palestinian leaders, if this happens again, we're going to kill you. Because then Hamas started bombing inside Israel. Now, I can understand rationalizations, but they should have been fighting Israeli soldiers in the West Bank. What they did was they gave Israel a gift, because the Israelis could not stand for Palestinians killing Israeli soldiers. Mm-hmm. That frightened them. This was legitimate resistance to occupation. But going inside Israel and bombing cafes, Israel loved this. They loved it. And bombing buses, they took a bus from Israel and they sent it around the United States to show how barbaric these Palestinians were. So they loved this. They don't care about Israeli civilians any more than any other government cares about civilians.
Hamas no government. Is the gift that keeps on giving. Now, of course, Israel was involved in the creation of Hamas, but they are the gift that keeps on giving. Israel needs those pretexts. And it's why I recently was in Los Angeles. I was screening a film about Palestine, and an audience member brought up a question or a comment, really. He said, why in the world, if you have this giant, you know, bully standing over you and you throw spaghetti at him? I mean, that's basically – it's a completely – ineffective and not going to hurt them at all, but it gives them a reason to pound you in the face. And that's, you know, like firing rockets into an empty field or something. And then as a result, thousands of Palestinians and all their infrastructure is blown back into the Stone Age or into the grave.
And the wall. This wall was the wall that Hamas built. Because if they had been attacking Israeli soldiers in the West Bank, as they should have, the world could not have said this is terrorism. Out of the attack, I mean, today the Israelis call every attack on a Jew in the West Bank, whether he's a soldier or not, terrorism. But the reality is, it's as legitimate to attack an Israeli soldier in the West Bank as for a Frenchman to attack a Nazi in occupied France, and there's no fundamental difference, except the Israeli soldier could have chosen not to be there, because in Israel you can refuse to serve. You might serve 14 days in jail, or you could leave the country, but the German soldiers didn't have the choice. So the Israeli soldiers are worse than the German soldiers, because they have elected to be there. But the point is that the Palestinians decided to give up armed struggle, and what happened is they have the wall, and they have this jacket of attacking civilians in cafes in Israel, which totally was counterproductive and wasn't fighting the occupation. I mean, the occupation is, of course, of all of Palestine, from the river to the sea. But the reality in terms of what the world would see would be fighting. I mean, they have guns over there. To use them against the Israeli soldiers would have been legitimate. It would have been supported. It's something resistance movements have done. So resistance movements to go and bomb, I mean, I cannot defend it. I do not support Hamas. I think Hamas, the Israelis did initially allow them to function as a religious counter to the secular PLO. Mm-hmm. But the PLO was so corrupt under Arafat that it didn't take. The people there would have gone against the PLO in any case, whether or not there was Hamas. So,
well, they get money from the U.S.
Pardon?
It was Hamas gets aid from the United States, not very much, but enough to ensure that it stays the way that it is. It was funny that I think it was Rand Paul introduced a bill to end aid to Hamas, and AIPAC actually opposed it. So they
it doesn't go to Hamas; it goes to the Palestine Authority.
Right, the PA. Excuse me. Yeah.
They pay some people. Hamas gets money from Qatar. A progressive country there, and obviously from wealthy Arabs. It's difficult to know. In the Middle East, things get very complicated. But the reality is, when people talk about unity between Hamas and Palestine Authority and Fatah, these are two organizations that have totally betrayed their people. I mean, whether it's Mustafa Barghouti or Hanna Ashrawi, all the people, they go along, they've allowed this Mahmoud Abbas to thrive. And here's Abbas going to Peres' funeral, and you see him shedding a tear. And now they're really furious with Abbas over that, but not over the collaboration of his militias arresting Palestinians. For example, when Israel was bombing Gaza and people were protesting the West Bank, you had the Palestinian militia, it's like Vichy France, repressing Palestinians. I don't know how they do it. It's difficult for me to understand what's going on. And for me, people also, well, you're not a Palestinian. This occupation has gone on now 67, but 48, how many years is it? 48, 52, 67 years. 60, the Palestinians simply have not found a way to do this. They have made a lot of mistakes. And so it is not out of line for people to look at that struggle and say where things went wrong.
Well, a lot of it's an American problem too, because without the U.S. support, I don't think Israel could possibly have made the gains they have or maintain the image they have in the press, especially because most of the world understands racial apartheid is a bad thing, and yet you're not seeing the resistance, as we talked about earlier about South Africa, the kind of sit-ins and demonstrations and humiliating the people who are supporting, racial colonization, which is completely indefensible. I mean, there's nothing they could say if there was press about it. That's not happening because of the COINTELPRO in the United States. And that's why I wanted to talk to you again about the Jewish Voice for Peace and what a canard that is.
Well, I'll tell you, I have been watching it from the beginning, and they've been watching me. As I found out very early on, they were monitoring me because of my obsession with the Israel lobby. And when KPFA at Berkeley Station wanted to have a debate between me and the head of the Jewish Voice, Sunday Mitchell Plitnik at the time, about the role of the Israel lobby in the Iraq War, he refused to do it, as did his second, a woman named Cecile Saratsky. So the KPFA got Stephen Zunis to do it, and he did a terrible job. But the very night that the debate was broadcast by KPFA, Plitnik was over in Marin County across the bay giving a talk about how the war for Iraq was not a war for Israel. And the longest article he ever wrote was about the Iraq war not being a war for Israel. So what essentially these organizations do, what Chomsky does, what Phyllis Bennis does, is damage control. And they're very good at it. And you have people who are accepted into the movement. Someone says they're an anti-Zionist. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, you're welcome. Well, someone says they're anti-Zionist. That doesn't mean anything to me. Also,
yeah, it's just a title if it's not backed by action. But before you go on, I want to make clear that the claim you just made about, Iraq was not about oil. It really was about Israel. They're saying the opposite. Talk again about how Bush Sr. resisted them and how James Baker and Bush and these oil guys opposed the second war in Iraq.
Oh, that's right. I sincerely believe from what I went back and read all the newspapers. I know April Glaspie had told, from the State Department, had told Saddam Hussein that his problems with Kuwait drilling, slant drilling into Iraq and stealing Iraq's oil, whatever he did was not a concern of the United States. And whether that was a setup to get Saddam Hussein to go into Iraq, into Kuwait, would never be proved. But Saddam invaded Kuwait, and George Bush Sr. responded by sending 250,000 troops to Saudi Arabia. But he kept sending James Baker over there trying to get Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait so he wouldn't have to use the troops. He was being criticized right and left by the Jewish columnists in the mainstream media and those who support Israel. And finally,
he had calling him a wimp, even though none of them have ever.
Calling him a wimp, even though he served in the U.S. military, which none of these chicken hawks, Zionist chicken hawks, have ever done. And so he finally went in, but he did not take Saddam out. This caused the same columnists like Mort Zuckerman, who the editor, the publisher of U.S. News and World Report, and the editor of the publisher of New York Daily News, Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post, Bill Sapphire and Abe Rosenbaum, the New York Times, to constantly write column after column attacking him for not taking Saddam out. And his reasoning at the time was that if he took Saddam out, it would destabilize the Middle East, and it would cause the U.S. to be in a quagmire that we could not extract ourselves from. And he was supported in this by James Baker, Secretary of State, and his Brent Scowcroft, his National Security Advisor.
Even Dick Cheney of the DOD.
And Dick Cheney at that time, who was part of his administration, also opposed going into Iraq. Then, and this is 2003, comes 2003, they are against the war. Cheney had now become the darling of the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the first neocon organization started in 1976, which was designed to intertwine the U.S. and Israeli militaries to the point where they could not be separated, which has succeeded. And Cheney was honored by them and was put on their board. And he went from one position to completely 180-degree turn and became an advocate for going into Iraq. And Brent Scowcroft actually publicly said that Dick Cheney in 2003 was not the Dick Cheney I knew before. In any case, in 2003, and the neocons, some of whom had been involved in writing something called A Clean Break for Benjamin Netanyahu, in 1996, in which they suggested that Israel take out Saddam Hussein, they were the ones who then were the heart and soul of Project for New American Century, which main position was to take out Saddam. And when George W. Bush became the president, a bunch of them, Douglas Feith, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Lou Libby, and David Wormser came into the Bush administration in key positions in the Pentagon and an executive branch, and they started fashioning the plans to take out even before 9/11, and when after 9/11 occurred, they were ready to go. Now, George Bush Sr., James Baker, and Brent Scowcroft, and then Norman Schwarzkopf, the military hero of 1991, all opposed the 2003 invasion for the same reasons they didn't take out Saddam in 91. And when the late Tim Russert...
He used to call them the crazies in the basement, referring to Wolfowitz and these guys that wanted to take out Saddam. Bush, it was like, they gave him Central America to play with, and they screwed that up too, but he used to call them the crazies in the basement. And then here they are making the Office of Special Plans. Not only writing, like PNAC wrote all of their rhetoric, they kind of recycled their own lies. They said all this baloney in the 90s, and then they said the same stuff in 2001, 2, and 3, just reiterating things they had already written but acting like it was current news. Like, oh, the lid's about to come off. It was Kagan's paper about the nuclear weapons capacity, which is baloney. Yellow cake uranium from Niger. Judith Miller's writing about aluminum tubes and all and anthrax and that BS. And then even Louis Libby, Cheney's chief of staff, was a lawyer for the Mossad agent Mark Rich, who the Clintons pardoned. So you have this perfect storm of neocons. The Clean Break was kind of reiterating Oded Yanan, sort of updating and recycling those lies. And yet that entire narrative, the OSP, which our own intelligence, our actual intelligence analyst, didn't even know that existed until a few months before the war started. You know, this is all happening right under our nose, and the Chomskys and the gatekeepers, they don't talk about the role of the Office of Special Plans or the Jewish lobbies or the Israeli lobbies at all. It's just, oh, they went there to hold their finger on the tap of the oil, which they, by the way, they did not even get. They went to China. They won't even admit it after the fact.
True. That's true. But it's interesting. PNAC was exposed not by anyone in the left of the United States, not by Phyllis Bennis, who's headquartered in Washington. You would think it would be known by someone like Phyllis Bennis, Institute for Policy Studies. It was released and published by the Scottish Sunday Herald. And that's because there's a group of scholars, pro-Palestinian scholars, at the University of Glasgow, who I believe gave the information to the Scottish Sunday Herald, and they broke the story of PNAC. And I don't believe Noam Chomsky has ever talked about it. Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Never talks about it. The Jewish Voice for Peace, of course, never talks about it. Nobody on any of these official groups ever talk about it. It's so extraordinary that anybody who would come from another planet would wonder what these people are doing. I mean, it's not that it's a secret. I mean, they kept it secret, but it became a non-discussion factor.
It's not ignorance either, because people like you, people like myself, have brought this up to these people. Like, and so we know that they know, but they refuse to talk about it. Democracy Later, or Democracy Now!, as you alluded to earlier, Grant Smith has this wonderful lawsuit documented based on precedent. It's airtight. Where's Amy Goodman's interviews with Grant Smith? Where are these people ever? Like, and on any of the books he's written, Divert, or, you know, why aren't they talking to Colonel Wilkerson or any of these people, Mastis? They're not. They don't. They just go back to Chomsky over and over again. They go back to the reliable sources who may be good on other things, and Democracy Now! Is fine if it's talking about Native Americans or Latin Americans or something that doesn't really involve the Zionist influence. They'll do a fair story, but
yeah, a very good story. Their coverage of the Sioux, Standing Rock Sioux, that has been tremendous. Coverage of Black Lives Matter is really great, but what they're doing is doing something that involves no risk on their part and gets funding from people on their part. But when it comes to, and even they will talk about Israelis' crimes against people in Gaza or the West Bank, because the people who run the lobby know Americans don't really care about the Palestinians, but they do care about what happens here, and they don't probably would like the idea that some other country is running a group of agents who are robbing American taxpayers of billions of dollars every year, more than we even know about.
We give more,
get away with it.
Trump has talked about, and I don't want to get in a tangent, but Trump has talked about Japan and South Korea not paying their fair share for defense, but the aid to Israel, the aid that, like, even one-fourth of the aid to Israel that America just gives away, these aren't loans that are repaid or anything, they're just giving them money, is more than the entirety of the South Korean defense of what they have to pay. So that,
well, it's a one-way street. Getting back, I mean, I interviewed Phil Giraldi, 20-year CIA veteran, the other day about Israel and the $38 billion. He says, he wrote an article for the Onion's review called a $38 billion scam. And the reason the scam that the United States gets nothing for. Now, yes, there are jobs, but there are plenty of other jobs. When you have every member of Congress voting to support aid to Israel, it isn't jobs anymore. And the point, and the other thing is you have members of Congress now, seven senators: Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, Kelly Wyatt, John McCain, and others. They are upset with the latest deal because Obama is very unhappy that Israel, the arms industry, is competing with American arms sales. And Obama has sold more arms to foreign countries than any president in history by far.
Yes.
And Israel is trying to compete with us selling weapons. And so up to now, it used to be that 25 or 26% of the arms allocation to Israel would go to Israel in cash, 26%. With which Israel could actually do whatever it wants. Theoretically, it's to buy weapons from the Israeli arms industry. And Obama, excuse me, has stopped that. So here we have these loyal U.S. senators, excuse me, who want to restore that. They want to get that 25 or 26% back to Israel, which would mean less American jobs. So we have people, these are traitors by any kind of definition. They should be frog marched to the Potomac and given and waterboarded. And yet you don't hear a word about this.
You know, Hillary wanted to quote larger figures for U.S. exports because of trade deficits, not mentioning that how much of our exports are guns and planes.
Well, actually, yeah.
And subsidized.
That's basically a major section. Matter of fact, rebuilding NATO was a little diversion. The America was critical because most of the countries in NATO outside the UK are not worried about the Russians, and so they're not happy with the sanctions against Russia. They know that Crimea was part of Russia for 300 years. And that the people there are Russian speaking, but it's another story. But the point is that where we sell arms around the world and we perpetuate wars, we make sure that everybody has enough weapons to fight with as long as they buy them from us. But there is so much on this subject. We were talking about Shimon Peres, and Shimon Peres. Actually, I didn't mention before, Shimon Peres he gave an interview with a columnist in the Jewish Forward talking about how important it was for the United States to take out Saddam, because he described this as World War III beginning, and that the U.S. was essential for this. So here's this great man of peace calling on the U.S. to support, to attack and take out Saddam.
That's why he gets the Peace Prize.
Well, getting back to Oslo, there was one negotiator for Israel named Shlomo Gazit, former head of Israeli intelligence. And he was speaking in San Francisco at a temple, Jewish temple, after Oslo, and I went to hear him. It's interesting, when I lived in San Francisco, whenever someone from Israel would come to town, I would go and listen to them. I never saw not a single representative from New Jewish Agenda at any event on Israel in the Jewish community, never once. And even at events where members of the Jewish community were complaining to representatives from Israel about what Israel was doing.
Well, explain New Jewish Agenda was started in the 80s as
serious organizing. Right, in the 80s. In any case, Shlomo Gazit was speaking shortly after Oslo had signed at his temple. And this is in liberal San Francisco. And he was being, I have to plug some electricity in here. He was being attacked by people in the audience were critical of Oslo, and one crazy German Jew ran down the aisle shouting, "Munich, Munich, it's another Munich," referring to the deal that Neville Chamberlain made with the Nazis that allowed the Germans to take Sudetenland from Czechoslovakia. And Shlomo Gazit said very calmly, "My friend, I don't like to make such a comparison, but if it's Munich, we're the Germans and the Palestinians are the Czechs." Now, I was there to record that, and I put that in an article in my Middle East Labor Bulletin and also in an article in Counterpunch, but that was the truth. This was a Munich for the Palestinians, and Yasser Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas were the Neville Chamberlains. And the idea that this would in any way benefit the Palestinians, there was nothing in Oslo that would spoke about a Palestinian state. It allowed the Israelis to actually have a large section of the West Bank for a certain period of time. But once they were their foot in the door, the Israelis are very famous for what Menachem Begin used to call facts on the ground. And Ben Gurion once said, "It isn't important what people say about Jews, it's what Jews do." And we have seen what they have done in the West Bank and excuse me, in Israel. They also, and I had to.
And in Lebanon. And
the Levant affair, which most Americans aren't aware of, it's the first terrorist act against the United States in the Middle East, in which the Israelis suborned a group of Egyptian Jews to get them to carry out firebombings of the British and American film libraries in Cairo in order to get the United States to turn against Egypt. And one of these saboteurs was caught going to a movie theater with this explosive went off in his pocket, and he confessed, and a few of these Egyptian Jews were hung, but this sent a message to the Arab countries that they could not trust their Jewish population, which was already in jeopardy because of the Zionist takeover of Palestine. I mean, you had Jews who lived in Baghdad and in Iraq for thousands of years. They were very prominent in business and the economy. And of course, when the Zionists wanted them to leave, and so when some of them didn't want to leave, they had Mossad throw bombs into a Jewish cafe to pretend it was the Iraqi government wanting Jews to leave. And that story was published in the Israeli Haaretz in 1953. But we don't hear these stories. And those people who support the Palestinians are willfully suppress every kind of piece of information that could help the Palestinians, such as the attack on the Liberty, such as the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu was exposed by Grant Smith last year, or maybe it was this, I forget.
A couple of years ago, smuggling Krychon triggers with Heli Trading Company.
Yeah, there was a smuggling operation on this end, on the American end, with an Israeli filmmaker named Arno Mishan, whose film was won Academy Awards, and he's the darling of the Hollywood set. In the middle was a guy named Richard Allen Smith. And on the other side in Israel, receiving these nuclear triggers was Benjamin Netanyahu. This was 1985. And this information came from the horse's mouth, actually. The FBI knew about all this. And they had a file. And Grant Smith, indefatigable, who's trying to get documents all the time exposing what Israel's done in the United States, which the entire left pays no attention to. Antiwar.com publishes some stuff. But finally, and I interview him, I've interviewed him a number of times, and I mention stuff on the air. But the rest of it is, he might as well not be talking. In any case, the FBI put out a document, and they did not redact that name. Now, grasp this out. It should be a big story. It should be in the mainstream media. It should be at least in the left media. But the COINTELPRO people obviously are not going to use it. Jewish Voice for Peace, U.S. campaign in the occupation, they're not going to use it. And when I try to tell people that the movement is occupied territory, just like every other critical sector of American society, they don't want to hear it. So they may
criticize.
That's for
Palestinian Americans too. They're comfortable and gotten out and don't want to risk losing that position. And they're so happy to have any, you know, they think some Jews on their side. And it's just not the case, though. But it's – the left is almost, to me, like a mental disorder.
It's a joke.
But it's a joke. They're obsessed with biological categories and just this nonsense. And you never really get at the meat of any issue on any topic. But they can't admit the actual causes for recent wars, for example, as we just went over. I mean, even after you explained it to them, like, you cannot deny the existence of the Office of Special Plans, and you can trace back every single pre-war lie and see its origins with these dual citizens with Israel, and they're still like, but my oil. It's just like, it's, I don't know.
You have this woman, Antonia Yuas, who goes around talking about oil. She's the expert on oil, and someone at a meeting asked her about the Israel lobby, and she's Jewish. Well, no. And she pretended to have no, really not, that's not, I don't have much information about this, she said. I mean, it's mind-blowing. It's very skillful. I'll tell you, it's interesting. In 1963, there were hearings held by Senator Fulbright, famous Senator Fulbright, which most Americans don't know about, because the occupied movement never talks about them. But they were held because it discovered that millions of dollars that American Jews were sending to Israel was being sent back to the American Zionist Council, the predecessor of AIPAC, to buy pro-Israel propaganda in the United States. So this turned out that Senator Fulbright had hearings about this, two sets of hearings, and on the basis of these hearings, Kennedy, John Kennedy, ordered by Bobby Kennedy to try and get the American Zionist Council to register as a foreign agent. But they delayed it until Kennedy was assassinated and it no longer became a problem. In any case, we could draw conclusions
from
that. Well,
both Kennedys were assassinated. Bobby, by a Palestinian.
Right.
So, allegedly.
Very interesting, too.
Yeah, I have a lot to say on that topic, but...
But anyway, getting back to the hearing, one of the documents that came out of the Fulbright hearing was a document of the American Zionist Council, which they planned to infiltrate, that's my word, penetrate every critical sector of U.S. society in order to propagandize it for Israel. Now... It is, and they have, you know, churches, the black community, they literally own the black community. The Congressional Black Caucus is like a House Negro Caucus for the Zionist lobby. Those members of the black members of Congress who had any guts to spoke for Palestine, the last one being Cynthia McGinley, were driven out without any support from the left. In any case, they manage, infiltrate, every critical sector of American society is dominated by the Jewish establishment. One would think, logically, that the movement supporting the Palestinians would be a target. But you never even hear suspicions that so-and-so is an agent. But I will tell you, I mean, I will say it, and I will, of course, they won't debate me. But I think the whole BDS movement has been used by Israel to actually increase their power here. For example, we have in California recently, they passed a law, 34-1 in the Senate, 34-1 in the Senate, and 60-0 in the Assembly with 20 abstentions. Those 20, we'll hear about it from the lobby. In any case, to make it, to protect Israel under a law that protects Californians from discrimination, because of race or identity. So Israel is included under California law. And then they
launched... It's like protecting neo-Nazis' racism by saying, hey, otherwise you'd be anti-white or something.
Yeah, but what's interesting is that the Jewish Voice for Peace had a campaign before the votes, but one of these campaigns to tell your member of the assembly what's going on in Palestine. And, you know, ordinarily, a way to approach members of Congress or state legislatures, you arrange appointments and you bring in information, and that's routine if you have an issue you're concerned about. But Israel is not an issue like any other issue. They own the American legislative process. It is totally occupied. So when, despite the best efforts of Jewish Voice for Peace, they got one vote opposing us to the whole California legislature. Then they launched a campaign to get Governor Brown to veto this. Now, Governor Brown is going to veto a bill which was passed 94-1, but they pretend, oh yes, call governor's office. And I said, I will not call the governor's office. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to play the fool. And of course he didn't veto it. He wasn't going to veto it. But, you know, I wrote an article recently for Dissident Voice, criticizing Phyllis Bennis, who claimed there was a massive opposition to Israel's actions in the United States, and particularly in the Jewish community, which is a total nonsense. There's no such thing, because there was no opposition whatsoever to the $38 billion that Obama has offered Israel, and that he was going to do that has been known for more than a year, and there was no mobilization against it. People were working on BDS. Well, BDS was fine for South Africa because South Africa wasn't getting money from the United States. And all of South Africa was targeted, and there was no South African lobby. So what the Jewish Voice for Peace has done is pretend they're doing something to act as if they are really on the side of the Palestinians, when they, in fact, are waylaying them and doing the work for Israel.
It's just Hewlett-Packard and Caterpillar. Motorola.
Yeah, Caterpillar makes these big, huge bulldozers they knock over Palestinian houses with. That is not the problem. It is a problem, but it is not the problem. F-15s are a bigger problem. And by the way, it was published, it was online, that besides the $38 billion, Israel is getting 10 surplus F-15 fighters that cost American taxpayers $28 million apiece, free to Israel, and 8 have already gone there. They're not charged on anything. They're not charged. This is like excess. It's like giving it to Goodwill. They give it to Israel. It's unbelievable. And, you know,
And they sold some to Saudi Arabia, which are being used on Yemen. Huh? But even with all the power of that the Saudis have, we're supporting their war in Yemen right now. Those F-15s were still at least sold, where they're just given to Israel, or worse, we give them money to pay for it, so subsidized through our taxes.
When Senator Cranston, California, was the senator, he was one of the most important senators for Israel. When Israel was still getting foreign aid, he passed something, became a public law under his name, in which the United States Congress guaranteed to give Israel at least enough money every year to pay what they owe the United States. Now, try to get that from a bank. So Ted Koppel, when he had Nightline, had a debate between a member of Congress, David Obey, who occasionally criticized Israel, and Stuart Eisenstadt, a Zionist member of the government. And they were talking about the $10 billion in loan guarantees back in 1991, which George Bush Sr. refused to give to Israel. And Eisenstadt was saying, well, what's the, there's no problem in giving this loans, co-signing these loans for Israel, because Israel always has paid what it owes. And Obi said, that's because we give it the money to pay us back. He said that on Nightline. Now, Ted Koppel, if he was any kind of a journalist and not a Zionist mouthpiece, would have said, what did you say? Did you say we give them the money to pay us? To pay us back? But no, he didn't. He just went on.
Because let that slide, hopes nobody catches it.
He let it slide because, like everything about Israel, they let it slide. There is the Israeli exception for everything. The laws of nature, maybe the only laws that apply to Israel, but the laws of the United States do not apply to Israel. It's mind-boggling.
They attack the United States.
Time and time again.
They attack the United States. There are survivors. Sorry, the audio is getting a little screwy there. I was saying, getting away with anything. They attack the United States with the USS Liberty. There are people still alive who survived that attack, and they cannot get the story out. And veterans who have heard the story are absolutely livid, but you're not going to see a Hollywood film about this.
What you're talking about, the Liberty?
The Liberty attack, yeah.
The USS Liberty. This is something. I'm a vet. Fortunately, I was in between wars, and I worked with Vietnam vets after the Vietnam War or during the Vietnam War. But here's a situation where during the Vietnam War, a U.S. Navy intelligence ship, not involved in the war at all, was off the coast of Egypt monitoring Israeli radio broadcast, and with a huge American flag flying over it, and lightly armed, and the Israeli planes came over and with insignia could be seen by the U.S. sailors and waved to them. It was a beautiful sunny afternoon. And then in the afternoon later, the Israelis came back and the planes evidently weren't marked, and they started strafing the ship, destroyed the lifeboats, dropped napalm, and then sent a torpedo boat which blew a big hole in the center of the ship. That killed most of the sailors. 37 sailors died, 34 died dead, 171 wounded. When Admiral Geis of the Sixth Fleet, when they heard about this, they destroyed all the radio contact except one managed to get through to the Sixth Fleet. Admiral Geis sent a fleet of U.S. planes, fighter planes, to go and counter the Israelis. And then he got a message from Robert McNamara telling him to call the planes back. And Admiral Geis said to McNamara, couldn't believe the order. Does the president know about this? And Lyndon Johnson came on the line and said, I ordered it. I don't want to embarrass an ally. That should have got Johnson hung by the neck, as a traitor in the United States.
Well, they helped him get into office.
Well, they helped him get into office. He was sleeping with a beautiful Jewish convert who had worked for Mossad.
Matilda Krim.
His wife's husband. Pardon?
Matilda Krim, who's an Irgun terrorist.
Yeah, right. And her husband gave a lot of money to the Democrats and to Johnson.
He was with Matilda the day the 67 war started.
No, yeah. Well, he evidently informed her. He knocked on her door to let her know the war had started. It's an amazing story. But the thing is the sailors were warned by the government that anyone, the survivors, who talked about it would be court-martialed. And they gave a Medal of Honor to the Commander McGonagall, but they didn't give it at the White House. They gave it at the Brooklyn Navy, at the Washington Navy Yard, and it wasn't by Lyndon Johnson. And it wasn't until Lieutenant James Annis wrote a book about the assault on the Liberty that some years later that it became known, but it still became a taboo subject among as much among the American left, as I wrote in an article recently, as among the Jewish establishment. So the American left has long been co-opted by, on this issue, by softcore Zionists, people or Jewish tribalists. It's no other way to account for it. I mean, I could go through a lot of experiences. I might write a book, The Left in Israel.
You should.
I did write an article some years back called, you can find it online, called Israel and the Left, Israeli Lobby and the Left, Uneasy Questions, published in Left Curve magazine, which was the only magazine with any print magazine with any guts in the United States. Published my article on Chomsky, published my article on Iraq's war with Israel, published an article by my friend Harry Clark on Chomsky, but no other American magazine would publish it. Actually, there was a magazine called Lies of Our Times. Ed Herman, a sometime partner of Chomsky, but totally agreement with me when it comes to the lobby, asked me to write an article on USA to Israel for Lies of Our Times, and another one on Israel Lobby. Well, when I went to write the one on
Lies of Our Times.